He's a legend among Indiana sports writers, and the best thing that ever happened to Bob Knight. Growing up in Huntington, Indiana in the 1950s, he fell into a job with a local newspaper after just 1 year of college at IU, and he never needed to go back as opportunities just kept presenting themselves. From Huntington to Peru, back to Huntington, then on to Fort Wayne, Kokomo, and Indianapolis, he blazed a trail around the state before settling into a dream job in Bloomington. He had incredible freedom at the newspaper there, able to write as often as he wanted, as long as he wanted, and even to break an occasional deadline when he felt it necessary. The thing was, though, he had the talent and work ethic to back up those privileges. He was minding his own business in Bloomington when Bob Knight arrived on the scene, changing the face of IU basketball, and indeed college basketball, forever. He was there every step of the way, becoming one of Knight's best friends. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Bob Hamill.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever. Pita Pit, have you had your pita today?
Today, One-on-One comes to you from the Cook Incorporated office of Bob Hamill, one of the legendary figures in Indiana journalism. And Bob, you were born in Huntington, Indiana, right? Or at least I know you grew up there.
Yeah, I was born there and grew up there.
Okay. Do you have an athletic background to speak of yourself?
Yes, a poor one.
Did you participate?
Well, my coaches didn't know it, but I went to a rural high school there for my first 2 years, Clear Creek High School.
Never heard of it.
And I didn't do much to make you hear of it either, but it was small enough that I was playing JV ball, that kind of thing. But then we moved to Huntington High School my junior year. There was no problem of thinking about going out for athletics.
No chance of that, huh?
No. Believe it or not, they had a radio station, and with his voice, I actually was on the radio.
You did the games. You did local Huntington games.
Yeah, I did.
Play-by-play?
Don Fisher was always hoping he could find one of those, but we didn't take those things.
Did you do like football and basketball both?
Or yes.
For the local Huntington station?
Yeah, for the high school station.
Yes. Yeah. But play-by-play, or were you the analyst?
Well, no, I was my senior year, I was a play-by-play.
Yeah.
Hallie Bryant came up and played against Huntington and had 22 at the quarter and 33 at the half.
Is that right?
I always remember that.
Wow.
39 for the game. But it was fun. I actually, the guy who did one of the really legendary games up there when Huntington played a team called Monument City, with had 10 boys in the whole high school and six, all of them played. Well, one was a manager. The other all played basketball. Actually, five of them were pretty darn good athletes and big. The final game went into overtime, and Huntington won it on a shot at the buzzer. And there was great consternation among the county schools that Huntington did have the timer.
Might have been a homer job.
No, but it was my broadcast came into the play in some of the letters to the editor.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. One woman told how she was there was 3.5 seconds to go, or 3 seconds to go, so after they hit a free throw to go ahead. And the guy described how his wife went out and popped popcorn while the guy on the radio broadcast his last 3 seconds, implying that they held the clock just a little.
Gotcha. So Monument City, that's another one.
That was the last game Monument City ever played. The town is even gone. There says it's under the Huntington Reservoir now. They're at the bottom of the lake. So,
wow.
In Huntington, we destroyed evidence. When
you cheat somebody and then destroy the evidence,
that's right?
Right.
Let them go.
Well, you're obviously a diehard sports fan from the beginning, I guess. I picture you as a guy who's not only reading the newspaper, but probably reading a lot of books and that kind of thing. Were you an avid follower of sports
much
from
so.
The beginning?
And primarily radio. I'm old enough, it's pre-television. It wasn't that I opted for radio.
You had no choice.
That's what we had. But I was very fortunate growing up there in Huntington because Hilliard Gates was just a great broadcaster. And I listened to him do Fort Wayne's Honor Piston games, and in football, college game, he had a different Big Three game every week. That was the way I first got hooked on IU, about following Indiana. George Taliaferro, his first game was as a freshman, 17 years old, and they went up to Michigan and won the game, 13-7. And I was 8 years old, and I became that afternoon. I'm a big IU guy.
Is that right?
And I always clipped out things and filled scrapbooks and followed their games every time I could. But it was much more at that point. It was football, not basketball. Basketball followed, of course, but the football is what really pulled me in. And and they did win the Big Ten championship that year. They tricked me. Same thing in baseball. The White Sox that year weren't very good, but they won their first five games. They were the last unbeaten team. Boy, I thought I wanted to a winner here.
Yeah, you thought IU football was going to be great forever, huh?
Well, it certainly was. It gave me a championship right away. Yeah.
They're nine?
I don't know. I just really liked it. And I think one of the things that Indiana always has going for it is it has that Indiana across the chest. And if you're neutral and looking at it, that's easy to adopt. And, and that's kind of what happened, I think.
Yeah, well, it doesn't take much to suck you in when you're a kid. It could be somebody's uniform. It could be one player. It could be one game. So, yeah, if you're at an impressionable age, it doesn't really take much to get you.
And you don't get off that horse very easy.
That's right. That's right. It's hard to change your allegiance. Did you have writing influences? Were there either sports writers or authors?
Because I read all the time, yeah, I did. I remember when I was 10. My dad was a policeman. And so we had a typewriter set up at home for the reports. And the Huntington newspaper, I worked there 9 years, and I think it's still the case. It's a Monday through Friday afternoons, no paper at all on Saturday, and then a Sunday morning paper. So I would go to high school games on Friday night. In 46-47 season, which was my sixth grade year, Huntington had a really outstanding team. It was a year Bill Garrett's Shelbyville team won, but Huntington was one of the four or five teams that could have won. They were very good. And I would go to the games, and they didn't sell season tickets then. So, assigned seats. Mm-hmm. They were just, you got there and you went to seat. So I'd go right after school. I got a prime seat right in the very first row, right behind the basket. And then a doctor from Huntington would come along about game time. He'd get there and he'd give me 50 cents. And I'd move out of that seat. He'd take us. I'd sit right down in front of him and sprawl my scorebook out and keep score.
So he was paying you to hold the seat for
him?
Yeah,
I was. Shoot, I made out that year.
50 cents a game, huh? Now, how long did you have to sit there to hold that seat for him?
Oh, I went over right after school.
So it was like hours.
Yeah, it was no problem. I wasn't passing up anything.
So like 5-6 hours you'd sit there hold the seat?
It'd be the JV game. It'd play about 6 o'clock. So it was we went to school a long time. And it was 4 o'clock when we got out. I go down and get in line and go in.
Okay, wow. And so then you lay on the floor, the gym floor, and you would keep the scoreboard?
I'd keep score. And then Saturday morning I'd get up. I'd take that typewriter my dad had. I knew enough to set the margins. I counted up the characters, and a newspaper line was around 25, something like that. So I set them to where I did. And I thought the toughest thing the writer had to do was get words that would do. I noticed that they would use hyphens and jump the words around a little bit. But man, I was part of it. You had to select increase your vocabulary.
You didn't realize there were machines to do that.
I didn't know that until I'm not sure I knew that till the first day I worked in a newspaper office. I'd type that out, then compare it the next Sunday morning with what the professional guy did, and I always learned from that. That was my beginning. At that time, I had really a pretty good voice. I had the lead in the opera in the operetta my freshman year, and then my voice changed. My musical career went out. But anyway, my dream career was in radio.
Okay.
I thought Hilliard and the guy who did Bob Elson was a Sox broadcaster then. I thought they had the greatest jobs in the world.
Yeah.
And that was where I was aiming, but writing was always in the back of my mind, and that and it moved to the forefront when my voice
went
out.
Your voice changed.
Hamill goes off to college, but only lasts a year. Hey, why go back when you've already got a job? When One-on-One continues. We are back on One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith with today's guest, former Bloomington Herald Telephone reporter and columnist Bob Hamill. He intended to go to IU and get a degree, but wound up getting a job after his freshman year. Before he knew it, he was working for his hometown paper in Huntington. Mom was impressed, but Dad would have rather had a good night's sleep.
So when you get out of high school, you come to Indiana as a freshman, right, as a journalism
yes.
major. And then when you go back after that freshman year, is that when you got a job on the Huntington paper?
Well, I was still down here, actually. It was about April that year. I got a letter from the editor at Huntington who knew I was down here to major in journalism. What he didn't know was that I hadn't taken a journalism class because they wouldn't let you.
Well, as a freshman, you couldn't take one
yet, You had to take liberal arts courses,
okay,
which was very intelligent. Way of going at it, but it didn't help me much in preparing me to go into that office. But he asked me if I'd like to do that during the summer while they looked for a real sports writer. And they just lost their guy. And like it? Yeah, you bet I would.
Yeah.
So but I went out. Mark, there's never been a greener guy go into a newspaper office. And I am not kidding. I'm not sure I did know that.
That wasn't. You thought you got to write your stories to make the margins fit, huh?
I don't know, because I'd never written a story for anybody. I never had a journalism class in high school. We didn't have one. We didn't have a school newspaper.
Didn't have a school paper.
Didn't have anything.
You didn't work on the Daily Student that first year, right?
No, they
weren't allowed to do that.
I don't know that I would have been allowed to, but I didn't even think of it to go there. Yeah. I thought that was probably for the journalism students.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't one. But, I was so green. That's what I mean. It was just dropped in my lap. I hadn't.
Yeah.
You hear it today. Well, you couldn't go into a newspaper career without a degree. Well, you couldn't then either. But they didn't intend for me to start a career there.
They just wanted summer help.
Trying to get me through the summer.
what did you get paid that summer?
$35 a week.
$35 a week. Do you remember your first assignment?
Well, I came in, and the first thing I had to do was write. I was sports editor at 17.
Sports? Oh, you're like a one-man sports staff?
Yeah, okay. I'm 17. I got out of high school early. I was 16 when I came there. I was 16 when I was down here for the first couple of months. So I was very young, and the first thing I did that morning, first morning, was they tossed me a couple scorebooks, and I did a summer league baseball game, American Legion, something like that kind of thing, you know. And a women's softball team. My walking things. My second story was on women's sports. And man, the story was no big problem. All I needed was a couple paragraph lead. Those box scores, Moses chiseled those things out of stone faster than I got those box scores. that was a real problem. But we got those out. I had two stories in the first paper, and then I'm in Huntington. That was sports. Was just about a third of what I did. I always had a beat of some sort, a city building or something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
It was great, great training for me. I was so lucky to be in a place like that.
There's nothing better than jumping in and just doing it.
Had to do everything and lay out all those things. Eventually, I didn't right away, but.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't go back to school then, right? Didn't you just
continue to
work?
To,
you had a job.
Yeah, I thought at the end of the year, I'm piling out. I said, I'll go another year. As I say, I was young, and mm-hmm. so I figured I'd just make up that year and have some money when I go back, and I'll, well, it just never worked. The next year, pretty soon I was romantically involved, and then we got married, and we had a kid, and all those things. So
yeah.
College. Every year, fall would come around, and I'm thinking, well, I ought to go back. But, I've always obviously wondered what would have happened had I gone the traditional way, the orthodox way, and gotten a degree and looked and joined the job market. But she, things worked out so great for me, and it probably would have been a different wife, a different family, and I'm not going to trade. I'm really happy with the way things went. So,
yeah,
I am curious as to what would have happened had I allowed my life to proceed a little more normally. But
well, your parents probably didn't mind, because instead of sending you to school, you're actually earning money. So,
well, sort of, although I was in journalism, so I wasn't earning money. I'm not sure they knew I was earning money.
At least you weren't costing them any money, right?
That's true.
No tuition payments.
But, no, out of that. Tuition in Denmark was $4 a credit hour. So a 17-hour load was $68.
Isn't that amazing? That's amazing to think about that. I read somewhere that the first column you wrote with your picture and everything, your first real column was on Chris Schenkel?
Yeah, it was. That first week. I started on
the first week.
Wednesday, June 9th, and Saturday I wrote that column and stole it basically out of a magazine feature on him as a young guy. He was just starting to do boxing telecasts out of St. Nicholas Arena in New York. And he wasn't a network guy at all at that point. He was still under 30. He was but it was this nice article on him, and I didn't even know there were laws against plagiarism there. I obviously did a lot of rewriting, but it was.
Did you interview Chris Schenkel for this?
Not at that point. No.
Okay, you just rewrote a magazine story.
Yeah, pretty much so. And it wasn't. You know, you were around to see some of my. Sometimes I wrote a great length.
You could do that. You had volume in your favor.
That one was not long.
Really?
it was kind of starry-eyed, but it was. I always got a kick out of the fact that the first one was on Chris. I
mean, yeah.
Because it was talking about this young guy and what a future he had. And
from Bibas, Indiana.
I sure called that one right. Now, Bibas is in the northwest part of Huntington County, so it was a legitimate thing, yeah.
Is it true you ran home and woke up your mom to show her the paper?
We lived about three blocks from the newspaper. I don't think I ran home. I was never that much of an athlete, but I quick-stepped home, and mom and dad were already asleep, and I threw their light on and thrust the newspaper. And mom, she was wild. She threw it through, and dad looked at it and went back to sleep. And, you know, I've mentioned that I always thought that was a good introduction to life, because if you get 50% of them that are pleased and the other half sleep through it, that's about right.
There you go. Yeah.
It's a good day.
Hamill finally gets out of Huntington and heads out on a journalistic journey that takes him all over the state when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, I'm Mark Monteith with Bloomington newspaper legend Bob Hamill. He finally got out of Huntington to advance his career. He tried Peru briefly, but his wife was homesick and he went back to Huntington for 4 more years. Then he was off to Fort Wayne for a year, where he worked outside the sports department, and then to Kokomo, and then to the Indianapolis News. And then, to his own surprise, he took a job in Bloomington. To say the least, that became a life-changing experience. Here's Hamill picking up the story when he was a newcomer on the Indianapolis News sports department, getting what turned out to be the offer of a lifetime.
John Banch had it offered, Ray Marquette had it offered, and you know how the staffs would kind of, the star people were coming in when we were getting ready to leave, and then we were on the same floor, and sometimes we'd get together in the back of our room, and sports guys would be talking. We were quite aware of both of those offers, and we kind of had a cumulative vote on that thing. You just can't leave the Indianapolis Star to go to the Bloomington Herald telephone, you know?
Yeah.
So then my offer came. Well, I went down there to do the interview and thought, there's no way it's going to happen, but someday there'll be an interview I need to practice for. So, the editor of the Bloomington Herald telephone was Perry Stewart, who was about 40 and blind, and one of the most dynamic newspaper guy ever is around. Just a great, great person. He outlined to me that, he talked then about sending me to the Olympics. Well, I'd never thought in terms of Olympics or anything like that. So I wound up taking it. And I was driving back, I'm thinking, you can't leave Indianapolis to go to Bloomington. but wait a minute, those guys had a lot better jobs than I got. They're columnists. They're doing things that I'm not doing.
What were you doing, high schools or something at the news?
Yeah, and I loved covering? It. I mean, I wasn't, you know, I was covering Larry Hybaugh and some really good people in high schools. At that time, I was Washington won the state my first year there with Keller and Bob.
Okay, 65.
So it was a really high water mark of for me of high school athletics. It was going well, but I took the job and I was so lucky there because so many guys. I don't know how many guys turned it down. Dave Kindred was one. Wow. At Louisville, and because Perry. He really loved sports, and he was going to make that a primary battleground. There was a new paper in Bloomington that had just formed, that was one of the things I think he heard about me, that I'd been in that kind of situation, and so I was aware of the competition that it's essentially mortal combat. Only one's going to last. he was a godsend for me. That guy was a. He died after I'd been there just a couple of years, but prior to then, he was a great teacher. He was a great motivator. And a great friend. We just had a lot of fun together, and he really helped me a lot and got me going.
So this is what, 1966 when you started Bloomington?
October 66, October 24th of 66. So my first full season of football was the Rose Bowl season.
Okay. And you're the sports editor, and how big was your staff?
I had one other guy. And the Courier Tribune, there was a new paper, and they'd taken the whole sports staff. They had the sports editor, Bob Owens, and about five or six guys that had been on staff there before. So we were battling every day. We were the entrenched paper, but they had sports.
Yeah. So somebody started a new paper and took the sports staff from the established paper.
Took a full sports staff with them. Including all the sports files.
Now, that didn't seem right.
Perry Stewart sued to get those back.
I was going to say, that ain't right there. So it's like two of you against, what, five or six of them?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
it was no wonder you got in the habit of writing five stories a day.
Yeah, it was. I was layout too. Good training.
yeah, and no shortage of work. Wow. So you're there in 1966, and everything's going along just fine, and then Bob Knight comes to Bloomington.
I was there 5 years
before he came in. What were your early impressions, and you know, what do you remember about that hire?
One of the things, my brother was a high school coach then, Jim, and when he heard who got the job, he called me and he said, "You can't believe how good a coach this guy is." He said, "I've been going to clinics for his for the last two or three years. He's the best there is." I said, "Well, that may be, but I'm not sure how those 51-50 games are going to go over."
Yeah.
Jim never let me forget that.
You're used to the Hurry and Hoosiers.
They'd win a national championship, and he'd call and say, "How are those 51-50 games going?" But my the first practice I went to, my whole feeling was, this is another whole century ahead. I mean, this is a whole different. I mean, the very first practice, what he was insisting on, what he was doing in that practice, made the rest of the Big Ten isn't ready for this. Yeah. And it wasn't. I think the big thing. Now your years there in the 70s, weren't they?
I was about you in the 70s. Okay. Yeah.
Well, in the were you here when Bob came?
No.
Okay. That first year, their fourth game was they was in the 90-89 double overtime at Kentucky. And I think that really, really made his spurs right there. Uh-huh. I think that sold Indiana people on him.
And
it was a game when Steve Downing was on a bad knee and played all 50 minutes and scored 47 points and 25 rebounds. It was an amazing game and a great, great performance, heroic performance. But it was a terrific win for that young coach over Adolph Rupp, you know, at that point.
And that
really kind of propelled them into popularity at the second year. Then they went to the Final Four and won the Big Ten. And so it was pretty much explosive from there. Mm-hmm.
Did you get along with Knight from the beginning?
Yeah, pretty much so. I'm not pretending there weren't blow-ups along the line, I think as much as anything, he observed pretty early that I did work hard. Mm-hmm. And I think it was kind of I don't think he ever thought – sports writer was anything other than basically a form of prostitution, but he looked at me as a diligent prostitute, I think.
I remember, I think you've told me before, I know he lost his first four Big Ten games. You know, the all-time leader in Big Ten victories was 0-4 at one time. And I think you recall him genuinely wondered if he could win in the Big Ten.
It was, they lost, the fourth of those games was up at Michigan State on a Saturday afternoon. And it was, and I'd driven up, and he didn't, he wanted to, it wasn't out of anger or anything, but he wanted to come back with me in car because he would, we went from, it was an afternoon game at East Lansing, and we went to Anderson to see Tom Abernethy play. Of course, that's South Bend Central, of course, South Bend St. Joe against Anderson. We barely made it, but in, it was in that trip that we're driving out over snow, and it's a messy, bright sunny day, but it was where everything's bright, really white. When we're looking out, and stopped off to a little roadside gas station and got some slicing bologna and bread and mustard and milk or something, and that was our dinner on the way down to Anderson. But during that ride, he says, "Do you think we'll ever win?" And I mean that, and he's meaning ever really get this thing going, but at that very point, he's wondering if they'll ever win again.
Yeah.
They just got beat by 10 up there. And,
well, you always had a close relationship with Coach Knight, and, you know, the hardcore journalists will say, well, you shouldn't be that close to your sources or the coaches you cover and everything. Did it ever get uncomfortable for you, or is that just the way – I mean, you came out of a different era of journalism, really.
Well, it's also the such a small town. Mm-hmm. You know, we're rubbing into each other all the time. But of course I heard that. Mm-hmm. But I really didn't have a different relationship with him from what I had with John Pont or the other coaches I worked with.
Right.
Essentially, they were the same thing. And and being a small town had a lot to do with it. I didn't have other places to go. I mean, everything was are you oriented? You know, you've been around me for a long time. I'm not exactly the most militant guy.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a conscious problem for me at all. I just essentially treated them the way I expect to be treated and the way I would treat any coach. Doc Houseman, Sam Bell, they were the same boat.
Yeah, and you covered Lee Corso the same way you covered Bob Knight,
right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I can't think of two coaches who are more at opposite ends of the spectrum
than
those two.
It was just my nature more than anything else in play there.
It kind of became a situation, though, as Knight got involved in so many controversies where you were almost – you know, had to defend him. I mean, sometimes journalists would call you to get explanations or do stories, and you would become a source for stories about Coach Knight. Did you get kind of tired of being his spokesman, so to speak?
I got a little tired of being portrayed in that position because those times that I defended him, it was genuine. I mean, I really felt that his stance wasn't what was being portrayed. To this day, I still don't quite understand the venom that a lot of people feel toward him because he had a temper. To me, that's down the line on those things that I would grade a coach down for.
Mm-hmm.
But my feeling on him was he followed every rule. He graduated his kids. He won more than anybody else did, and he had a bad temper. And if I'm going to grade him, he gets no worse than an 85 or something for points off for the temper. But the coaching end of it, I don't think anybody ever did a better job than he did in building a college program and adhering to every rule and every intent of a college basketball program, including bringing in great kids and getting degrees. I don't understand how he's held in such contempt by so many people because that to me was the best coaching job that the Big Ten's ever seen.
Did you ever write anything critical of Coach Knight in a column?
Oh yeah, well, when you talk about these incidents, obviously it comes out critically. I mean, when he throws a chair, it's kind of hard to make that sound like it's glamorous.
Yeah,
it was just plain stupid. I mean, there was no other way around looking at it. It was a very dumb thing to do. One of the things I remember with that year, you remember how things just went to just completely the seed with that team. And they were losing home games. They were losing. Steve Walford couldn't shoot. It was just a he had a 5 or 6 game stretch where they lost 5 straight home games. Mm-hmm. And after they, I mean, that was all entwined with that that chair throwing thing. But you know, I don't know whether truthfully it was kind of a carryover from the Olympic experience, and he just kind of burned out. And maybe Steve had to. It was the next season after they'd won the gold in Los Angeles, and man, they had a lot of basketballs unbroken. But it did just really disintegrate. And I don't know in that course of that period when he threw the. He had thrown the chair. Now they do make it into the NIT, and they played well once they got to the NIT, and they went to the final game. Reggie Miller beat them with the UCLA, but it was a good game. But one of the interviews out there, the mass interview, some guy said something about, do you ever regret something you've done? Do you ever wake up the next morning and regret something you've done the night before? And he says, well, sometimes I regret it when the chair's halfway across the floor.
I remember that. I remember that in New York. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. He could always save himself with a sense of humor. He'd go on Letterman and make a joke about it, and he always knew how to play those things. But you had periods with him when, like, he kind of shut you out, right, or wouldn't give you access or talk to you.
There was a pretty substantial. But it was over summer. It didn't make a whole lot of difference.
I mean, I remember a time like the year I covered the team for the Daily Student, which was the only season he didn't go to a postseason tournament, the 76-77 season. You know, like 5 guys quit the team that year, and one of them was Rich Valavicious. And I think, as I remember it, tell me if I'm wrong, you wrote just a very simple, even-handed story about Valavicious leaving the team, and he got mad at you for that and cut you off. And
he was, it was – talk to the guy and get interviewed.
Yeah, you
with
got a quote from Valavicious.
I don't remember what he said. Normally, I didn't particularly write my own headlines, but I could. That particular day, I didn't. And one of the most inflammatory things in the course of the story was boom right across the top.
Oh, the headline,
And it that didn't go down well.
Oh, okay.
So it was about a 6-month period before we talked again.
That's amazing to me, though, that a coach cuts you off for 6 months because of a headline. That he should realize.
But I own the headline. It was in the story. I don't mean to dodge. I don't want to put it on the headline writer. It was my story and my quote.
But it was accurate, right?
Yeah, it was.
I mean, I'm guessing you don't regret the way you handled it.
No, there's no way around. But it's just one of those things that is going to happen. You had it happen, I'm sure.
Sure. He kicked me out of practice when I was covering the team.
I mean, even without Bob, there are other guys that they have something that you felt you did just normal coverage and. It goes down hard with other people sometimes. So, but that was not a common problem at all. But it was a very quiet summer.
Well, you probably enjoyed it. Was it? Did you ever go to him and say what is going on? What is with you? Or what's your problem? Or you know that kind of thing?
No, not really. There again, that probably comes into my non-confrontational thing. I'll just let this thing work out, and it will. And it got into the. Season and 77-78 season now, and and I'm thinking, he's gonna have to talk at press conferences over the, but now they're in their lead up months, the weeks now after they start basketball practice October 15th, I'd always have a basketball story on Sunday morning, well. I knew that if he really was dead serious on shutting me out, he just tells the players they don't talk to me, and they wouldn't. Right. But so I went through them every week, and I'd talk to Steve Boucher or somebody about how things are going, and make a feature on that player. But again, we weave in some of the things that they were doing in practice. So I got through that period all right.
Yeah,
and it was kind of an ordinary game more than anything else, and I made it a point in all those Sunday stories, never once was his name mentioned. And I thought, nobody out there would pick that up, except Bob, but he did. And it was, you know, there were animosity. They were just kind of a fun thing. I can write IU basketball and never mention Bob Knight.
Yeah.
So the season starts, and I think, well, now, after the first game, he's got to have a press conference. That's the year he decides he's going to write out his post-game
hand
remarks
were
released through Kit Klingeloff.
Yeah.
That was my rule. I mean, all you other guys suffered because he wasn't going to back down and talk.
Hamill calls it a career and looks to the future when One-on-One continues. We're back on One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, talking today with former Bloomington Herald telephone columnist Bob Hamill. He retired from full-time work at the paper in 1996, but has kept busy ever since. He recently wrote a book on Bill Cook and has a few others in mind as well.
The newspaper industry has changed so much since just even 1996 when you retired. Would you want to be working in it today, given the constraints?
I know that it would be a vastly different situation because the best thing I had going for me in Bloomington was autonomy. The people here, the management here, just essentially put me on my own to use my own judgment. If I felt we needed to cover something in New York, I didn't have to ask anybody. I just went.
Mm-hmm.
But they expected me to keep it within where I'm not making ego trips. There's a legitimate local reason why I would be there. But I would go to the Final Four every year. I'd go to the Olympics. And it was a phenomenal position for a small paper. The autonomy was unbelievable. I mean, I was known throughout the building somewhat as the late Mr. Hamill, because if I felt like we needed to miss a deadline to get a story in, we missed the deadline a little bit.
That's what I mean.
A lot of it.
Yeah, that's unheard of.
Is. Again, I tried not to abuse it, but my concept of not abusing it and some of the circulation or the composing room, you know, that. Yeah. But they were, even there, I never had a complaint against that. They had every reason to be irritated with me, but they would needle me, but
yeah.
They were really behind me 100%. I just had a phenomenal working situation here in Bloomington.
Are you glad you weren't still working at the paper when Knight was forced out?
Yeah.
It would have been hard for you to cover that.
It would have been difficult. Yeah, although I was still on the op-ed then. Uh-huh. I there were some things that I was fortunate that I was out of sports when Bill Mallory got fired.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have been easy for me either. In each case, I wrote columns, but it wasn't the same as being the voice of what was going on there.
You're obviously still in contact with Knight?
Yes. You still? We talk about probably every 2 weeks or so.
Yeah. Do you think he'll ever be back on campus here?
No.
Not at all, never.
No, I really don't. I think it's I think he feels that he and I don't mean to be speaking for him, but my interpretation is that he thinks that he'd given Indiana everything he could have asked for, and they ended his career for him, essentially. And
mm-hmm.
I think the soft word would say he resented that. That in no way ties Fred Glass in or a lot of people here. I think Fred Glass was essentially the one that put him in the Hall of Fame here, which was absurdly late. I mean, how can you have a Hall of Fame, an athletic Hall of Fame in Indiana, and not have a guy like that in it? But Fred did that, and I think Bob has a pretty good feeling for Fred and a lot of people. But then there are a few that don't qualify under that.
Yeah. So have you tried to advise him on that? Have you tried to say, come on, you know, let bygones be bygones, or do you just stay out of that?
Not that particular argument, because I know how he feels, but I think he realizes that I would enjoy it if the things worked out a little better. But I understand why he doesn't. I haven't ever pushed it in that sense. I think that's his call.
It seems my impression is that over his years here when he did coach, that he often turned to you for advice. Is that accurate?
I'm not sure I'd categorize it under advice.
Okay.
Oh, no, we just had a good relationship. There were a lot of funny times, I'll have to say that. When he used to, when he calls, we just start out in the conversation. It's not, hi, this is Bob. You know, we don't go through with that.
Yeah.
It's boom, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of times he called and say, this is after when he was still here. He'd say, no. You aren't going to like this.
You'd be laughing, though, huh?
And usually I didn't. But no, we had those. That's part of what I have to consider the time period when I was really lucky, because there were a lot of things that I was part of that I enjoyed.
So you've written a book on Bill Cook, the Bill Cook story. Mm-hmm. What's in your future here?
Well, that's a really good question, because I'm not sure myself.
I've got an office here at Cook Incorporated.
And yeah. I want to write a memoir and try to get across exactly how lucky I was. And then the number of terrific people I was exposed to and introduced to from that small town job is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And I like to get into that. I want to do a book on Bill Mallory. He's a example of a man who really loved to coach and loved mm-hmm. and oh, coached yeah. for all the best reasons and still does. Still lives it and still has his sons in it. And I just admire that guy so much. He's a good friend of mine, which is another example. I mean, I don't know that my relationship with Bob was any different from what it was with Bill,
yeah.
and still is. And John Pont was in that same category.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've toyed with doing a book, kind of linking the 45 and 67 seasons, because I am familiar with both. In 95, I was still in sports, and I did a story every Friday, the matching date of the games that season in 45, and there were enough of them still alive I could call them, and George Taliaferro being one, and a number of others. That I even have the title, by the way, for that football thing.
What's that?
Twice Upon a Time.
There you go.
Now, I'm not sure that we get a lot of IU backing because it was an implied negativism there, but they are two great stories. I would like to do that sometime.
Got a theme question that I've asked everybody. It doesn't really apply to sports writers as much, but especially when you were working at the Herald Telephone, when you were sleeping at night, would you have dreams about your job? Dreams of that related to your job?
You know, I think, I still have them.
Yeah, okay.
And they involve the terror of being behind a deadline and trying to get something done. I'm going to miss this. I still wake up in panic sometimes. It's bizarre because since I was never forced to deadlines very much anyway, I don't know quite why. I guess it says that even during all that time when I was breaking, this would be a shock to the composing room people, but I really didn't have a conscience.
You would have dreams. You still have dreams
I really
that you're
do.
Missing
I still
deadline.
Have it. Yeah. I don't wake up where I've got myself into some terrific bind I don't know, are we ever going to get this paper out of my head?
I tell you what, when I was doing makeup, I'd have the same dream. Like, you just can't get it done. Something kept going wrong, and you just can't. It's 3 a.m, and you can't get it done.
My last sports page was 15 years ago.
And you're still
Am I ever going to get out from under this?
One-on-One continues in a moment. Hey, thanks to Bob Hamill for contributing to the One-on-One cause. You know, Hamill's an old-school journalist. His friendship with Bob Knight and other coaches certainly violated modern-day standards of journalism, but he's a product of the 1950s, and as he said, he's not a combative person by nature anyway. As he also said, he covered all coaches the same way, and that's why I believe he's one of the best things that ever happened to Knight. A columnist with a different approach would have clashed with Knight constantly, or been run out of town trying. Regardless of what anyone might think of Hamill's approach, you cannot question his talent and work ethic. He was good enough to work in a major market, but he was in the perfect place for him. Now remember, if you want to hear this or any of the other One-on-One conversations, the podcasts are available on the website. Just go to 1070thefan.com, click on shows, click on weekly shows, click on One-on-One, and you could spend days listening to conversations with Indiana sports legends. My email address is mark@1070thefan.com if you have a comment or question. And I'll be back next week with yet another spine tingler right here on 1070 The Fan.